Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Naylor's Natter, and this week I'm in conversation with educationalist, author, writer, consultant, orator, and liberal artist Mr. Martin Robinson. Martin is a teacher with 20 years experience of working in state schools in London. Martin was an advanced skills teacher, head of department, head of faculty, and an assistant head teacher. Martin is interested in developing teaching and learning by building on the tradition of grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. So we are looking this week at what I consider to be an essential read, namely Athena versus the Machine. And this book has fundamentally changed my views on the rationale for a knowledge-rich curriculum, moulded my thinking on extracurricular activities, and engendered somewhat of a state of cognitive dissonance in me when Martin talks about educating for freedom. And you'll know that I reviewed this book in last week's podcast pedagogy section of the show, where we looked at Martin Robinson's curriculum, Athena versus the Machine, and we talked about how it explores the educational value of a curriculum rooted in the pursuit of wisdom and advocates the enshrinement of such a curriculum as a central concern of an academic institution. And Martin argues that teachers need to be liberated from policy-led prescription in order to design curricula which brings the subjects forward rather than the pursuit of outcomes. So before we get into a wide-ranging and fascinating chat with Martin, we have this week's TDT section, and it's a little bit different this week. So we have some information from one of the Teacher Development Trust schools in Blackpool, and this is from South Shore Academy, who are talking about a teach meet that they're putting together as part of that project. So Nikki Smith and Emma Hall are in a Blackpool studio to talk to this, so over to you two.
Hi Phil, thanks for having us. I'm Nikki Smith.
And I'm Emma Greenwood, and we're here today to talk to you about a brand new South Shore Academy Teach Meet. You need to save the date on the 16th of January, and it's at 4 o'clock until 6 o'clock at South Shore Academy in Blackpool.
So we wanted to talk about where we came up with the idea and what we're hoping to achieve. It was Emma's idea initially because we absolutely love the local research events. We've always gone to Leighton Teach Meet, we've been to Research Ed Blackpool, we've always come away with excellent ideas. So we wanted to create something where we could share and celebrate the superb teaching and learning that's going on, not just in our school, but across all the Blackpool schools.
We're really excited because we've got a range of speakers discussing teaching and learning, strategies, behaviour, ethos and well-being.
We're also hoping to have reps from companies like GL Assessment, Lexonic, Teach First. We're hoping to have the Alliance for Teaching and PTI there so that, as well as the sessions, people can take away a variety of decent information that will help them in their practice.
So we're going to have a keynote speaker, and the first person will be Stephen Tierney, and then we're going to have breakout sessions for you to choose from.
Just as importantly as that, after our closing speech, there will be a raffle, so make sure you hang around for that too.
Okay, so you need to get your tickets now. They are free, so come along. You can get the tickets from Twitter. They'll be on our school website, or you can look out for the flyers that should be dropping into all Blackpool schools and in the Northwest soon.
They're selling out fast, so make sure you get yours soon. We're really looking forward to seeing everybody there.
Back to you, Phil.
Thanks for having us.
This week on the podcast pedagogy section, I am reading Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. And I have to admit a certain amount of bias before I start here. I am a huge fan of Gladwell's work, from his debut The Tipping Point, which explored the science behind viral trends, through Blink, Outliers and David and Goliath. And I'm also a regular listener to the Revisionist History podcast, Malcolm's journey through the overlooked and misunderstood. And in each episode, Malcolm re-examines something from the past, an event or an idea or even sometimes a song, and asks whether we got it right first time. So I was incredibly excited to receive this book and get stuck in. And I've so far managed to read the first couple of chapters where Gladwell re-examines Neville Chamberlain's famous pre-World War II meeting with Adolf Hitler. And history has not remembered Neville Chamberlain well, portrayed as he is at best gullible and at worst by Winston Churchill as guilty of making the worst decision ever. Gladwell skillfully analyses Chamberlain, a businessman with limited real-world experience, like a vicar stumbling into a pub is one way of describing him in the book. And his experience on a foreign stage made him much more likely to accept Hitler at his word. He then contrasts that with Lord Halifax, who was Neville Chamberlain's foreign secretary at the time, who, despite vast experience in foreign affairs as Viceroy of India and a charismatic and experienced negotiator who had brokered agreements with Gandhi, no less, was equally fooled by Hitler. So as Gladwell points out, the only politicians who weren't fooled were those who'd never met Hitler. And this seems to form the central theme of the book, Talking to Strangers. It changes the way that you look at strangers, yourself, and your kind of role within the world. And this is a research-based book which examines the varying ways we misinterpret or fail to communicate with each other. And I really found it a brilliant page-turner, and I recommend it to you all alongside Gladwell's back catalogue and his Revisionist History podcast. So the book is available everywhere, everywhere that books are sold. And for those of you that enjoy an audiobook, there is that as well, available everywhere, and no doubt narrated by the author. Okay, so hello, Martin, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, very good, thank you. Very good, especially on half term, so it's nice to be able to have a relaxing morning and chatting about education. What better way to spend your half term?
Cup of coffee and put our feet up.
Well, exactly. I actually have got one next to me. I can hear that there. Hear the china in the background.
Slurping away.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so we're going to get into the sort of gentle introduction question. So could you just tell listeners a little bit about your career to this point and what prompted you to write Athena versus the Machine as a follow-up to Trivium?
Right. I mean, I could start from a very young age and work my way through to the elderly gentleman you hear before you now. But my career in education started, I think, basically when I left school at 16, having had a rather desolate experience of education and finding myself working in a market stall, amongst other things, in Oxford, surrounded by students who'd obviously had a slightly different experience of education than me. And finally, I found my way round to getting a degree thanks to the Polytechnic of Northeast London, and then being open to students who had different life experiences, and finding myself doing a degree there, and finding the world of education rather late, but in a very interested and interesting way, in that it was quite a radical polytechnic and quite a radical course I was doing, and engaged in the culture arguments and culture wars of the time, because I was doing cultural studies, so I took it was probably a Marxist view on the world, you know, and that was my introduction to quite a few philosophers, writers, etc., who I had hardly anything to do with when I was at school. And finally, after leaving that, working in advertising for a bit, but for Marxism Today, as a communist newspaper, communist magazine. I was selling advertising space as a rather odd thing to do with a communist magazine, I suppose. I found my way into teaching, and I worked as a teacher for just over 20 years in Northeast London, in state schools in Northeast London, and as a drama teacher and an English teacher. And I even did media, I think, for 1 year or so as well. And then that took me through to senior management and various other lofty positions, like being an advanced skills teacher and all those sorts of things that were around at the time. And then I got a chance to talk to people via Twitter, funnily enough, and a chance to write a book on the Trivium. And that sort of opened up a new world to me, which is the world now of consultancy and writing the follow-up to Trivium, which is Athena versus the Machine. So that kind of gets me to this point.
Perfect, perfect. And that is going to be the focus of today's podcast. So in my view, this book stands intellectually head and shoulders above anything that I've read on the curriculum. And it starts with...
Kind.
You know, it's very true. And it starts with, if you haven't read it, listeners, it starts with a quote from Lord Byron and moves into the Athena school. So how do you propose the inspiring figure of Athena can change what can be a mundane narrative of too many of our schools?
Well, it's... It was asking, really, what is the inspiration for schooling at the moment? And how do we judge whether a school is being successful or not? And whether, how do we judge as parents, because I'm a parent, of course, as well, as well as a teacher, and as well as a student all the way back then, whether we've had a successful education, really? And it was following that sort of questioning down the line, I came across Neil Postman, and he had a talk on YouTube, which turned out it was from one of his books, The End of Education, written in 1996, I think. And he talks about a God and the fact that we need a God to give us some sort of structure for meaning. And if I get the quote here, a God is... God, in the sense I'm using the word, is the name of a great narrative, one that has sufficient credibility, complexity, and symbolic power so that it's possible to organize one's life and one's learning around it. Without such a transcendent narrative, life has no meaning. Without meaning, learning has no purpose. And that kind of summed up for me quite a lot of what was missing from a lot of the approaches to education that we're seeing around us. And which God could it be, I thought. And in a, because I'm not a believer in a Christian God, for instance, I looked for other gods, and I thought, well, Athena, goddess of wisdom, could perhaps give us a nice myth that we can structure meaning around, and an idea of a pursuit of something other than just grades and jobs and careers and all the other things that come through a more mechanistic way of approaching education. So something transcendent gives us purpose, gives us meaning.
And then you go on to contrast the wisdom of Athena with the machine. So can you outline what you mean by the machine in an educational setting?
Right, well, that is, I suppose people call it factory schools. I think that's kind of perhaps where the analogy can fit in. But it's mechanistic thinking, machine analogies that go throughout schools as well. Things like flight paths, you know, that we sort of enter there and we're going to end up here. Targeting, input, output, all the things that sort of the systems that we put in place which seem quite mechanical. And almost to the point where the mechanism takes over from the educative value of something you're studying. So even with conversations with students, they're looking for how to get the grade rather than how to understand the thing you're teaching. So it's all means to an end. It's all target-driven. It's all about clanking them through some sort of mechanistic movement that takes them through, and it's a well used idea. And to me, it takes the human out of it. The human becomes secondary, and the human, what I mean by the human, is someone who engages with the learning, the person who comes through, who's actually looking at stuff, thinking about stuff, and engaging with the stuff that you're teaching, and trying to get that relationship back to the center, rather than, right, how do I get this grade? How do I achieve this target? And all the other things we put in the place of that central relationship, the human and the knowledge.
And moving into the curriculum, we hear much about, you know, superficial talk about knowledge rich and broad and balanced in the discourse on curriculum, but knowledge as a means to an end in itself is not enough. So how can we go about designing curriculum to make inroads into people's minds rather than treat them as empty vessels to be filled?
Right. So this comes down to where I got with wisdom. So if you look up wisdom, and it has... In the Oxford English Dictionary, they kind of put it into three major parts that make up wisdom. And that is the idea of knowledge being central, and experience, and judgment. And so if we have those three things, knowledge, experience, and judgment, and we're saying that these are the central things for an education in the pursuit of wisdom, then how do we bring in a child's experience and also experiences? So this is, you know, they're going to be experiencing as they go through the schooling as well and on the outside of school. And also the importance of judgment, allowing them to make judgments, to have choices, to come into the conversation and to say, I think if we talk about the best, and perhaps this is something that's quite apt here, because in the national curriculum, it asks us to teach the best that's being thought and said. And that course comes from Matthew Arnold as an idea about culture, the best that's being thought and said. Well, I'm sort of saying here, well, actually, no, you can't teach them the best, because that bypasses them making a judgment about what the best might be. And also they might, of course, because of their experiences and because of their way of engaging with the world, not agree with you that something is the best. And so therefore we have a conversation about bringing them into that idea of judgment. But that judgment needs to be educated as well. It needs to be developed in some ways. As an arts teacher, this is very close to my heart, because we would make new art. We would be creating theatre, you know. And students had to learn how to judge whether something new that's never been seen before that they were creating was good or not good. So they had to develop a palette, a way of seeing the world that they can make judgments about what they're doing and what they're bringing to it, as well as when they go to the theatre themselves to see things, to make judgments about those things. And all these add up because of values, because of the way that they think things are important or not important, add up to the conversation that we have about what's good and what might not be so good. So the best is not something you can teach, but it's something that becomes part of the conversation about what the best might be.
Absolutely. And when we talk about, you know, knowledge-rich curriculum, we often link this to social mobility. And I got into some trouble with Professor Michael Young when discussing social mobility. He stopped me mid-sentence and said, for people to be socially mobile, we need people to be moving down as well as up. And he said, that just isn't happening. So I guess the question I'm coming around to is, should we stop talking about social mobility as justification for these hoop jumping assessments and micromanagement, and not having qualifications as a means to an end that are not shaping our lives without the sort of the values, ideas and meanings that need to sit behind them?
Yeah. And I agree with what Michael Young said there. Absolutely. The problem with social mobility is, like you say, in order, if depending on the society in which you're in, of course, at the particular time, that if you want, if what's the top job? Queen is the top job in the country. Well, you know, Charles wants to be, well, he doesn't want to be queen, he wants to be king, doesn't he? But in order for him to become king, the queen has to die, you know. So in the end, there's some sort of, is there room at the top for us all? It becomes a thing. But also, all the way through that, education is not about just having the top jobs. Everyone has a right to an education. Education can provide solace to us, can provide meaning for us, no matter where we are in the world. You know, whether we have a top job or a non-top job. You know, what do you call the job of a nurse, of a school crossing person, of somebody who's, tomorrow is dustbin day here. For me, you know, what are all these jobs? Are we saying this is the detritus of failed education around us, or are these people absolutely right to have a good education as well? Because education is not just about a means to an end. It's an end in itself. We say that here's some knowledge for you, here's some thinking for you to get engaged in, to think about the world in which you're in, and here's, you know, if even if you go to the most important occasions of life, whether it be the birth, marriage and death, perhaps to give a sort of traditional view on these things. But what poem do you read at these moments? What poem do you read out about, you know, if you're at someone's funeral? Which one do you choose to sum up a life or to bring meaning? Which songs do you sing at the karaoke? Which novel do you take on holiday? All these things are cultural judgments that you're making in your life about the things that you value, the things that you care about. Education helps us in these things, all of these things. It's a whole life, not just about jobs. And yes, of course, there are important things you learn at school which can help in the world of work. But that should not be the justification for having them in the curriculum. The world of work should be taking on the schooling that we give as full human beings and saying, well, here's the world of work, and this is how we bring human beings into our world of work. You know, so if you've got a job in banking or something like that, then of course mathematics has helped you get that job. But mathematics is so much more than just the job of banking.
No, absolutely. And I think about that in terms of the context of where I work. So I work in a, you know, a mixed kind of area in terms of, you know, advantage or disadvantage in an economic sense. Yeah. But we look at sometimes we talk about knowledge as a means to an end so that you can be socially mobile, which seems to naturally assume that you will move out of the area and take all of that with you. So actually, what I liked about what you were talking about was the knowledge, not as a means to an end, but to allow you freedom of thought to be able to make your own choices and actually enhance the area in which you live and serve.
Yeah, and there's a lovely play called The Pitman Painters, which talks about the miners at the Ashington Colliery before the war and about how they had this one of them particularly had a choice of moving away from the colliery and becoming a painter and being a full-time painter rather than a miner who paints. And there's this wonderful moment where he has the choice to live a life away from his family and friends, if you like. And he says no, because it will take away who he is as a person. And so he carried on as a miner who painted rather than becoming a painter who used to be a miner. And that's such a crucial conflict. And I think it is a conflict, and I think it's irresolvable. Because, you know, some people do want to move away and some people want to stay. And some people, when they move away, move to the big city or to somewhere else, which is culturally vibrant, apparently, at the time. And those who stay behind, therefore, are non-culturally vibrant. And I think that's wrong. I think home and away are two very different worlds, if you like, but both of them of equal import. And we have to enrich in where we're from as well as where we go to as well. And both those things become an important part of education. And culture is all around us wherever we are. It's hugely available to us. And it's our everyday, you know, and it's to say and celebrate. And you're in Blackpool, aren't you? I mean, Blackpool has such a vibrant culture that we all know about, you know, and some people might look down on aspects of it, but I know notice that Strictly go there every year, don't they, into the ballroom there. And that's such a rich environment, and that dancing that we see on the television and Blackpool there and that history that goes with that tradition is an important part of an education, you know, which is why dance should be in the curriculum, which is why the performing arts are so important, you know, because there's more than one way of making meaning in this world, and the arts are a very important part of it. And you know, should we go to Blackpool Rock as well? I don't know, you tell me.
We should always go to Blackpool for every kind of rich, diverse cultural experience that anybody could wish for. Definitely. We might come to
Absolutely.
That later on.
And social mobility, I mean, the other point with social mobility is it to some extent it's a myth that anyone can sort of be educated and then reach the top, and it's as easy as that. I mean, there's interesting research into this, and I think they've done surname studies right back to the Norman conquest in this country, and have sort of come up with sort of some sort of algorithms or whatever have worked out that there's been hardly any social mobility in this country since the Norman conquest. So we're pretty much in the same sort of order. We might be slightly better off than we used to be, but in the same order, you know, the same surnames are at the top and the same surnames are towards the lower end, should we say, you know. So us Robinsons, you know, probably aren't at the top so much as certain names that reappear over time. And I can't think of, you know, which ones those might be, but there is evidence of that. And there is also evidence that, where can we find it? The meritocracy, if you like. I think it's Gregory Clark, who's professor of economics at the University of California. He's done some work on this. And he's come up with the idea that pretty much we do not change the rate of social mobility. And the answer to social mobility is still at its pre-industrial pace, even after the Industrial Revolution. The only time that there was any particular change was just after the Second World War, which was due to the changing jobs market, not down to education. And the changing jobs market there was the big change in technology, and also that there was, you know, after two world wars, there'd been a bit of churn about, and certainly the male population. And what happened to mobility there was moving from industrial work to more office work, but still the hierarchy remains in place. You know, we're in the same order, but we're doing slightly different work. And that's pretty much what came out of it.
Okay, so moving on to cognitive science. So we talked about the machine before. So do developments in cognitive science lead naturally to an input-output brain as a computer-style curriculum planning? And why do you argue that the mind is not a machine?
Right, well, this is two lovely little quotes here from Raymond Tallis, who really helped me into thinking about this. The idea that the mind is a machine, I use a quote from Richard Dawkins, who talks about us, we're basically robots. And to some extent, you can see that. We have a sort of robotic life in some way. We're gene machines, I think he calls them as well. But Raymond Tallis sort of comes in with an idea about how the input-output, and there's a problem with the causal connectedness of input-output. And actually, there is something else going on here. And that is, we can understand how stuff goes in, is retained, and then comes out in that we say things, you know, so we can, you can teach me something, it can be retained, and then later on I can recall it. What we don't understand so well scientifically is how, when I'm teaching that to somebody, they look back at me, and they're looking out at me, and they're having their own thoughts and their own thinking. They are conscious of me, and they're conscious of what I'm saying, and they're making little judgments about what I'm saying as a teacher when this is going on. And the scientific world finds it very difficult at the moment to decide what consciousness is, and also about free will, about having the choices that we have, about whether we have free will. And this becomes an important theme to me, is that the child looks at us, and we look at them, and we look at the things we're talking about as well, the things we're teaching. And that relationship, to me, becomes very important, which is not a purely causal one. I cannot say, here is something, it's the best, there it is, here's the best, I don't know, here's the best play, here's the best piece of music, here's the best poem, here's the best cup of tea, I don't know. You know, and they will not just accept it. They have their own version of this. So generally, It's where does the human being fit in, which is the person who looks out at the world around them. And where does the human being fit in, as well as the person who then has their own judgments to make and their own free will, within huge constraints, of course, of the culture, of time, of their own genes, etc., etc., etc. But still within that, the human being is the thing that becomes important to me. And when we educate for the human being, we educate slightly differently than we do for something that's just a machine, if you like, a machine that comes out with a grade at the end. Bring the human being in, and suddenly we have to see that we have to deal with this in a slightly different way, subtly perhaps at points, but we have to bring them into the conversation. We can't just expect them to learn this stuff, bring it out in the exam, and then end up as socially mobile at the end of it. No. I hope that makes it clear.
And well, it does make it clear, and I just think about conversations in the classroom with, you know, why are we doing this sort of conversations? And then, yeah. You know, you do find yourself trotting out things of, well, it'll be on the exam, and you think, oh, actually, well, yes, that will help you to then get a better job. And it's a sort of a linear, you mentioned flight path progression between I teach you, you recall, you trot out an exam, you get good job, you leave area of social disadvantage, you become yes. human at the end of it. But actually, becoming human is part of the process all the way through. It's not something that you achieve yes. at the end of it.
That's right. And they're human right in front of you now, you know. They're human all the way through. And the now is very important, as well as the then. You know, if school is all about what happens in 6 years' time, I tell you, I had a child who I think it was in my first class I ever taught, and he got a lump on his neck, and it grew and grew and grew, and it turned out to be inoperable cancer. And what do you say to him? And he came to school every day. He stayed from fifth form to sixth form, and he got all the way through to year 13. He did his A-levels, and it was about 6 months after that he died. And that lesson stayed with me forever, really, because what is he doing there in my class, you know? It's not about the future, it's about the now. And teaching him was a joy, but, you know, a heartache of a story that goes with it. And he taught me the lesson, that lesson. You teach for meaning, for purpose, for the now, as well as the future, as well as making sense of the past. All these things come together. And it's so important that we deal with the people in front of us in that way, because some of them are not going to have the lives perhaps that we would want mapped out for them.
No, absolutely. Okay, so just moving on to the chapter on science and scientism. This really challenged my thinking. I hesitate to call myself a scientist. I do teach science. Are our best bets and what has worked valuable starting points for a curriculum, do you think?
Yeah, I think... Yes, I mean, if we're saying things like the work of Dan Winningham and Robert Bjork, et cetera, I think it's very important, and science is an extraordinary, and cognitive science has an extraordinary important role to play, and cognitive psychology has real important roles to play in how we educate and how we think about the world and the world of education. What I'm arguing for is that there are other things as well. And I mean, I think science can explain everything in the world to us, but I don't think that would be enough. And the thing I hold on to is Douglas Adams' point of when deep thought is asked about the answer to the great question of life, the universe, and everything, and deep thought pauses and then comes up with the answer 42, you know, that science can take us to a point and say, well, here's the answer, this is it, and everything else, and then we sort of look at that and say, Well, yeah, but there's a lot of other things that we need to do go on to understand what's going on here. So if we say things like interleaving, if we say things like spacing, if we say things like obviously testing for recall, all those things there are very important things to use, and we should use them without a doubt. And this is a vital part of education. But beyond that, what are we teaching? Why are we teaching it is very important as well. So it's not just recall anything. There's the qualitative nature of what we're teaching, and the quality is a subjective thing rather than the objective thing. So the objective thing might be 42, but the subjective thing of what we're talking about and why we're talking about this and what value these things have, I don't think can be arrived at objectively, scientifically. I think we have to look at these things subjectively and therefore go through very difficult discussions and arguments about what we should include, why we should include these things, and what value these things have. And I don't think those things can be given a number at the end and say, oh, that will make them more socially mobile, or that will make them have more cultural capital, or all those things. I don't think it can come like that. We have to make subjective decisions based on values, based on what we believe as teachers are important things to teach.
No, definitely, definitely. So just moving a little bit away from the science, so I'm going to look at extracurricular programs. We mentioned that before, but just to go off on a personal anecdote to start with. So Child One, as I'm fond of calling him on the podcast here, he's he's about to go to secondary school. So I've been on the tour of lots of different secondary schools to have a look at, you know, which one would suit him best, etc. So we've been to pretty much everyone in the geographical location of where he lives. And one of the things that struck me was one school proudly said that they have an hour for lunch, and they are not changing having an hour for lunch, because that is the time that pupils, particularly pupils at a disadvantage, have an opportunity to engage in extracurricular activities, and they run lots of clubs and societies and sports activities at lunchtime. And I just thought, how different is that from perhaps some of the other schools who are shrinking lunchtimes down, you know, reducing the number of extracurricular activities? And I understand that, and I'm not criticising them for doing it. But I guess the question I'm meandering around to is, how important and underemployed are extracurricular programmes? And, you know, can schools help alleviate the narrowing opportunities that particularly disadvantaged pupils seem to suffer from?
Yeah, so school choir, one of the most glorious things anyone could be involved in. And I speak as someone who never was in a school choir, but seeing my daughter go to school choir and the importance she attaches to that. School choir happens at lunchtime, huge queues, huge queues to get your lunch, you know, so you rush into the queue, you rush over to school choir, and then you sing. What more could anyone want? And because it's not judged as a number at the end of it, it's not necessarily going to get you your maths GCSE or whatever, then people perhaps don't value it as much. But for some kids, that can be the richest thing they do that day at school. And it certainly can be the sort of thing that can hang around you for the rest of your life. Of course, whether it be chess club, whether it be Dungeons and Dragons club, or whatever, I think that's coming back in, isn't it? Whatever it happens to be, there's these things that can give, well, sanctuary for some kids as well, but also camaraderie, not just hanging around together, which nothing wrong with that, but hanging around together, but doing something together is such an important and rich thing, which is immeasurable. And but is it wise to do? This is where Athena comes in. Is it wise to do it? Well, do we feel it's wise to do it? Is singing together a good thing? Is the choir a good thing? Yes. And that's how Athena can judge it. That's how the machine might say, yes, but we've got this high accountability culture. We need to do this, 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 and this. Therefore, we haven't got time for it. And that's the machine and Athena, in one conversation on one lunchtime about whether we have a long enough lunchtime to do school choir, or we reduce it and we fit in extra lessons on maths, et cetera, or whatever it happens to be. What's wiser?
I mean, we're seeing some movement in terms of, I mean, I dread to mention Ofsted already in a podcast, yeah. But we're seeing some movement in terms of, you know, Daniel Mears's work on the research of personal development, for example. So, you know, school climates that are supportive and nurturing, you know, fit the context of the school. So actually, we are seeing a little bit of, you know, rollback from you should be spending your lunchtime doing extra lessons, catch up, you know, duty, all of these other things, and actually more to around, you know, giving those, you know, experiences that people don't get necessarily in the classroom.
Yeah, exactly. And education is a whole. And, you know, Ofsted, I think, are looking at the subjective, the things that you can't quite put a number on, the importance of the culture of a school as a whole. And of course, that is also the community around the school as well. You know, everything that can make a community work in some ways, whether it be museums, whether it be libraries, whether it be all these things around the school as well as the school itself and the culture that goes on in the school, it's an extraordinarily important thing. And it's something that the best schools do very, very well, you know. And if you get to a point where you're having to make choices about taking away the things which structure the institution, but you don't know how important they are until they're gone, that you suddenly find out, well, perhaps we shouldn't have done that. Perhaps we shouldn't have sort of squeezed the arts. Perhaps we shouldn't have done these other things, the choices we've made to increase certain things and decrease other things. But these are very real decisions schools have to make for the very obvious and real needs that they have, whether it be accountability, whether it be staffing, whether it be rooming, all these other sorts of pragmatic choices come into play, of course. So I don't knock schools for taking certain choices, you know, which perhaps they would prefer not to take. But also, where you have the possibility, what do you do? Well, you try and keep together a whole, and that staffing time as well. You know, if you're expecting staff to work after school every lunchtime, et cetera, I think certain things have to give and take. And I think, you know, we have to think about those things as well. So how can we structure things in a way that's fair to staff, let alone to the pupils as well? But certainly think about how to make the creative life of the school come alive at lunchtimes and after school as well as during the school day.
And just think something that struck me as you were talking there is you think about, you know, I go into lots of schools, but I work in quite a large school. And you think of the number of people that are outside at lunchtime and the number of staff that are required to supervise that number of people out at lunchtime. And you think, well, if they could be doing something more constructive than just basically standing around and talking to each other, which of course has its merits, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yep.
You know, they're not sort of mobile phones because we don't have those, but you know, yep, you could think that the staff are willing to do that, so perhaps an extracurricular club or something would be, you know, supervision and enrichment.
Yeah, absolutely. And also there is an argument. I mean, we could we can dream perhaps sometimes, but you know, even things during the school day, having subjects that aren't, you know, in a secondary phase, for instance, have subjects which aren't examined, which are, you know, doing the school play or being an orchestra during the school day, not just at lunchtime and or after school. Yeah. So you don't have to just have subjects which are going to end up with a grade at the end of it. So, for example, if you've got, I suppose you've got your attainment 8, et cetera, et cetera. But if you've got room on the timetable for 9 or 10, 9, 10 could be choir. It could be school play. It could be orchestra. It could be debating. It could be whatever, or science club. It could be whatever these things happen to be, which are just for themselves. But, you know, we can but dream.
We can and we do. I'm just conscious now that, Martin, we're moving into sort of past what I've called commute length, which is what I like to keep the podcast to. So have you got time for a couple more questions? Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up a couple of threads that we've mentioned earlier on. So We mentioned Arnold's work earlier on in terms of teaching the best that's been thought and said. So you mentioned this before, but how can teachers go about, you know, encouraging pupils to make up their own minds in an educated way rather than simply, yeah, you know, going along with that to the best that's thought and said?
Yeah, so the way I talk about it in the book is we look at interleaving and juxtaposition and putting things next to each other, comparing and contrasting, dialectic arguing. So we put things together and we sort of say, well, here's this poem, it's the best. We put together two or three poems and say, right, here's this poem, here's this poem, here's this poem. This is why they might be considered good. Right, what do you know about these things? Right, what do you think about these things? What do you think is the best out of those? And then we have those choices made by the pupils at that time.
Absolutely. I was just thinking as you were talking there. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thread to pick up is, I mentioned that I was very fortunate to speak to Professor Michael Young, and he makes a strong case, as you know, for powerful knowledge. And if I've got this right, he talks about a curriculum that moves beyond the experiences that pupils would get on a day-to-day basis anyway. So he talks about not necessarily teaching things that, you know, you can experience, teaching things that are, you know, in similar to what we just talked about with Arnold, so the best that his thought said. But you talk about how you've got sympathy with the views of Professor Young, but your views diverge a little bit. So could you just outline a couple of areas where you differ, maybe?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because, I mean, I agree with Michael's work and I love his, you know, Future 1, Future 2, Future 3 curriculum. Now, if you look at his Future 3 curriculum, which is the one he extols, then I would agree that so much of that, but there's a couple of things that I do sort of worry about slightly in the terms of what we've been talking about. And that is its distinction from common sense knowledge and the knowledge acquired through everyday experience, I think. And I worry about this in the case, I can see it in an academic sense, but what about the case of the arts and about developing taste and developing people's sensibilities? Because to me, that's very much working with their common sense, the everyday experience, and expanding on that. And also, it's specialized moving beyond, and I think you've just mentioned that, the moving beyond the, not just the everyday, but also it becomes objectified. And it talks about objective knowledge. And I'm talking very much about the subjective side as well. But yes, there is more objective knowledge, and I suppose there is also more subjective knowledge. And I see that, and I think it comes particularly those of us who work in the arts and see this slightly differently, that the knowledge we talk about is not objective. It is very much arrived at subjectively and through discourse and thinking about things and bringing yourself into the picture. So those are the two areas where perhaps I diverge somewhat.
And the last question, if that's okay. So you talk later in the book about the sequencing of knowledge. So how important is the sequencing to ensure that children can make meaning of the world?
Yeah, narrative. I think this becomes the joined upness of the curriculum. How do we tell the story? The story becomes vital. And the story starts at the beginning of schooling right to the end of it and also carries on, you know, how do the stories continue afterwards? So it's about grand narratives, something that the postmodernists thought of as should have gone, have destroyed around us. I think that the grand narratives is very important. They give us structure, they give us meaning. Meaning is from the stories, the metaphors, the way we see the world, how we explain the world around us. They give us the structure for our cultural lives being in the culture, in other words, being in the world we live in. So the structure of the story needs to be thought about. What's the story of our curriculum? What's the story of our subject within the overall curriculum that we're telling? And how does every teacher sort of realize that they're teaching a chapter in that story, and they should know about the chapters that follow and the chapters that have come before, and how they actually tell that story in a way that perhaps opens up the narrative for later, as well as perhaps brings the narrative from the years before to some sort of semblance of understanding all the way through.
Well, that's a nice point to end. So speaking about the chapters, and I just wanted to say that, and I said this to you off air, you know, I felt completely invigorated reading this book, and it's really changed my thinking on a lot of those areas that we've outlined here. So firstly, thank you for writing it, and secondly, thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Well, thank you, and thank you for approaching me and asking me to talk this morning. It's such an honour, and it's so lovely to hear that.
And if you want to, if you want to come and physically talk about this, you know, Research Ed Blackpool would be very, very happy for you to come along in March and come and talk to us about this. But I don't expect a live on-air answer.
Oh, well, I'd love to. You know, I've never been to Blackpool. The only time I've seen it is flying over to Ireland, and I've seen the promenade from above, but never actually been there. So I'd love to come along. Thank you very much.
Fantastic, fantastic. So last little bit. So are you going out and doing quite a lot of talking about this book, and where can listeners maybe find out some more about what you're doing, what you're saying, and where they can find the book?
Well, they can find the book on Amazon, I expect, and also I'm doing various research heads around the country and other countries, and also I work as a consultant, so I end up in various schools and other institutions, and I'll be talking about it and talking about curriculum generally.
Great, great. Well, thank you again, Martin. Thank you for this morning. Really appreciate it, and great to talk to you.
And thank you.
So enjoyed talking to Martin there. I could literally have spoken to him all day. So if you haven't seen the book, or you haven't got the book, then what are you waiting for? Get onto Amazon and get that ordered and have a read of Athena versus the Machine. So into the shameless plugs section, and I'm plugging something that doesn't exist yet, but we're going to be looking at New Ed coming up to the northwest of England. So just keep, I'll keep you posted. We've got more details on what that looks like. I just like to keep mentioning it so that Emma Turnham falls off the running machine at this point of the podcast. Also, I mentioned last week, BrewEd Aussie, so again, not Australia, but Oswald Twistle in Lancashire, so I'll be speaking about curriculum at that. I believe tickets are going very nicely for that now, so if you haven't got one, get one pretty quickly before they sell out. Less of a shameless plug and more of a thank you. So thank you to Karen and the team at UK Ed Res Chat for allowing me to host last week. Really, really enjoyed it, and thanks to those that engaged with that as well. Really was quite difficult to keep across the retweets, and my typing is just appalling. So apologies that I didn't get many responses there, but really enjoyed it. Hope to do that again, and I'm a big fan of that hashtag, and I always like to join in on a Thursday evening when I can. So this is, again, less of a plug and more of a plea this case. I'm still looking for contributors to the podcast pedagogy section. So if anybody is up for a 1 to 2 minute clip on something that they have taken from the podcast and used in their practice. So again, it's moving from talking to teachers to having an effect on your practice. So I'd love to hear from you. It's not an onerous thing to do. It's literally record it on the voice recorder app, on the phone in front of you. Send it across, and you could be playing out to hundreds of people every single week. So yeah, if that's for you, send me an email. All the details on the show notes and on my website, which is nailersnatter.co.uk. Okay, moving into Teacher 5 a Day. And Teacher 5 a Day is something that I've been following and been passionate about since its inception, I think, probably about 5 years ago now. And Martin does a fantastic job of raising the profile of teacher well-being. So Teacher 5 a Day, as listeners will know, promotes five different things. So it looks at connect, notice, learn, volunteer, and exercise. And there are blogs coming out via the Teacher 5 a Day Twitter feed and through the website. And I'll be interviewing key people in the Teacher 5 a Day steering group, of which I'm proud to be a part. So thank you, Martin, for that opportunity as well. And I'm going to be speaking to Lisa Fathers and Bucky Youssef. And there's also a National Teacher 5 a Day Week, which is coming up pretty soon. So that's December the 2nd to December the 6th this year, to raise awareness of teacher well-being in every school of the country. So So check out that and post your experiences via the hashtag #TeacherFiveADay. So next week I'll be chatting to Tom Rees about wholesome leadership, so hopefully you can join me then. And I'll also be giving away Tom's book to a lucky listener who retweets the link to the podcast. And this is part of Jill Berry's Pass It Forward or Pay It Forward from her podcast. It's costing me a fortune, by the way, but it's worth it, all the listeners, it's worth it to make sure that we're passing on that experience. So Tom's book is fantastic. If you want the opportunity to win it, post with hashtag #NailersNatter onto your feed with the podcast and I will do the draw on a Thursday evening and get it in the post to you first thing Friday, so it's a nice treat for you on Monday morning. Okay, so it just remains to say, until next time, thank you for listening and see you next week on Nailers Natter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.